morning. It's wonderful to be here today, and it's wonderful to see everybody here, and to be able to once again worship God and fellowship with one another. If you'd like to turn in your Bibles, my scripture that I'll be basing this lesson off of this morning is 1 Corinthians 10th chapter, verse 13. It talks about, and Brian actually mentioned this in his prayer this morning, and I appreciate that. But it talks about man falling into sin or temptation, but God gives us a way of escape. And so I was thinking about this. Each one of us, I mean, if you've been in any of the commercial buildings, you'll notice that there's exit signs that are lit if the power goes out so that people can find their way to the door. There's, if you go to a theater, there's exits that are designed to help people in case that there's an emergency or one of the exits has been blocked. It's a way of escape. And most notably, if you've flown, and I think probably everybody has flown in a commercial airplane, you'll see that they start every flight with a briefing on emergency exits. Why is that? Have you ever thought about that? Why do they take the time to tell us about an emergency exit? And it's in case something goes awry, you have an understanding of how to get out of that airplane. It's a way of escape. Because they're telling you, there's not going to be a car or a truck that rolls up with stairs for you to get out on. That's not how it's going to work. This is going to be you having to follow our instructions and a specific set of criteria to get out of this plane if you want to stay alive. So I think about this in life. We live in this world and we're very concerned with safety, with making sure that we have captured all those ways to keep ourselves from danger. And if danger occurs, do I have a plan to get out of it? But do we do the same thing spiritually? Do we think about how we walk through this life and we walk in a world that it's filled with dangerous situations, and have we thought about a way of escape? Well, God has. He's thought of a way of escape, and He's going to tell us, if we read His Word, how to do it. So in 1 Corinthians, the 10th chapter, He says here in verse 13, He says, "No temptation has overtaken you but such as is common to man, and God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with the temptation will provide the way of escape also, that you may be able to endure it." So this word temptation that Paul talks about here, it comes from the Greek word perasmos, which is a temptation which is common to man. But really what it is it's a test or a trial. That's what he's saying. When you have a test or a trial in life, it's a test that is common to man. And it's God using these things. Think about this. This is God using tests or trials to help develop us. Sometimes we look at them the wrong way. But there's no man who walks through life that doesn't have tests and trials. There's no one who's immune from temptation. Jesus Christ was not immune from temptation, was he? He endured tremendous temptations throughout his whole life. Everything that we've endured. And it helped to develop him. And he did what God said. He followed God's plan. James chapter 1, verse 2. James tells us there that we should count it all joy when we fall into various trials. So we need to have the right focus, the right mindset about how we're going through life and how we address these things as they come up and how we're going to get through them. So I'm going kind of fast because I have a lot here and I don't want to take all day to do this. But in Job, and I'm not going to go through the book of Job. I think we've all read the book of Job and we all understand that here's a man who was tested by Satan. Satan requested from God the right to test Job. And what we see with Job is a man who continually fell back on God. He had three friends who came up and he says, "You didn't even give me good advice." And we see at the end of Job that God said, "You didn't give him good advice." He had one friend that did give him good advice. He's not included in those three that God tells you go to Job and ask him to pray for you. But what we do see with Job is that continually he reflects on God on the blessings that God gave him, on the short time we are here on earth, and the importance. He actually says in the 19th chapter of Job, verse 25, and this is the only verse I'm going to read out of this, but in Job 19:25, in the midst of all of his testing, he's already lost his family, he's lost his wealth, he's lost his flocks, he's really lost his friends even at this point if you think about it. And this is what he says. Verse 25, 19. And as for me, I know that my Redeemer lives, and at the last he will take his stand on the earth. So where's he put his confidence? Back in God. In spite of everything that's going on, he says, I know that my Redeemer lives. He's not worried about restoration of wealth or homes or family or anything like that. He's looking for a spiritual home already. He's already looking for that sanctuary that God provides. And so I'm going to spend most of my lesson today looking at Lot. And I think we're all familiar with Lot, Abraham's nephew. Lot chose that green pasture. He chose that land that looked better, and he took his herds when he and Abraham split their herdsmen up, and he says, I'll go over here. And Lot settled in the town of Sodom. And I think we all know through history and through studying the Bible that this was a corrupt, violent, terrible place. If you would, turn to 2 Peter, the second chapter. And beginning in verse 7 of 2 Peter chapter 2. And if he escaped, well, let me go back to verse 6. He says, and if he condemned the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah to destruction by reducing them to ashes, having made them an example to those who would live ungodly thereafter, and if he rescued righteous Lot, oppressed by the sensual conduct of unprincipled men, for by what he saw and heard, now listen to this, by what he saw and heard, that righteous man, while living among them, felt his righteous soul tormented day after day with their lawless deeds. Then the Lord knows how to rescue the godly from temptation and to keep the unrighteous under punishment for the day of judgment. You know, throughout my studies and throughout looking at Lot and Sodom and Gomorrah, I've scratched my head and I've said, why did he stay in Sodom? Why did he settle in Sodom? And I'm sure every one of you think the same thing. What was going through Lot's mind when he decided that he was going to settle in the city of Sodom and stay there? I can't answer that for you. I have some theories. But what I think is important is what Peter says here. For by what he saw and heard, that righteous man, while living among them, felt his righteous soul tormented day after day with their lawless deeds. So we have this man, and he's living amongst men who are ungodly. You know, if you go back 1,000 years, 2,000 years, 500 years, 100 years, do you know that we've been living amongst ungodly men throughout the creation of mankind? Do you know that is a constant, that we live amongst ungodly men? And did you know that ungodly men have been tormenting other men for the entirety of humanity? Do you realize that? So in that capacity, Lot's not unique. The very things that he faced, we face today. He stayed in this city. I don't know why he chose Sodom, like I said. But I get the idea that part of the reason Lot has stayed is because of his family. You think families have an influence on our Christian life at times and how we serve God and the choices we make? And I'll show you why in a little bit, why I think that. But Lot he's chosen to stay in this city, Sodom. And it says, Peter says, but his righteous soul was tormented daily. That means that he was worn down. That word tormented means he was worn down by everything that he saw and heard. He says that the temptations Paul says in 1 Corinthians 10:13, he says, these temptations that we face are common. That tells us that they're those temptations or those sins that by human nature man does. It wasn't something new invented. It's what man in his evil desire and evil passions has done throughout humanity. Common. They did it then, they do it now. It influences us. It affects us. It makes life living godly harder. Right? It doesn't take a person who's superhuman to see it, and it doesn't take a person who's superhuman to figure out a way to not be part of it. But it does take on each of us thoughtful conviction. We have to be thoughtful in our life serving God, and we have to be convicted in God's way. So remember that Paul is talking, when he writes this in 1 Corinthians 10, he's writing to Gentiles who have been converted to Christianity. Now, what we do know about Corinth is that the philosophies of the Greek and the philosophies of the Romans was very strong in that area, and men measured their worth by how much philosophy they had learned and how they applied it in their life. We know that these areas were full of these temples to the gods and idolatry worship. And we know, based on this conversation that Paul's having with them, that one of the things that they did was they made these sacrifices to them, and then they took the meat and they sold it in the market, and people came and ate this meat. So Paul's telling them, he says, you could eat this meat if nobody knows it, but if it's going to cause somebody to be offended by that, or if you're being offered this meat by somebody who believes in these gods, don't eat it. You don't want to be part of this whole thing. Make a conscious decision on when you eat this meat, how you eat this meat, and how this meat's going to affect other people. But there's nothing in this meat that makes it righteous to this God or anything else. But what he's telling them is, I understand, you're living in this society where all these different thoughts and these views are opposing you in serving God. So remember, you're going to be tempted by this. Be thoughtful and be convicted in the choices that you're making, and God's going to help you through these difficult times. So there's a great division that exists, we know, in the books of Corinthians amongst those brethren. This is something that we can read about through the pages of that church there. And so we understand that these things happened in that society. But what God has also said in 1 Corinthians 10, and this is the part that I find so interesting for you and me and so comforting. He says, God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with that temptation will provide the way of escape. The way of escape. Now, here's the interesting thing. Now, we have to think about this. And keep in mind, you're on an airplane. And the airplane catches on fire. And they say, there's exits over the wing, and there's two exits in the back. Move to the closest exit. And you say, you know, I know there's an exit at the front. And I'm sitting in the front, and I'm going to the front. Now, somebody's just told you there's a way of escape. And you choose to go the other way. Do you think that you're going to be good? I've actually been on two burning airplanes in my life. One I had to get off of, and one we were able to get on the ground. And I can tell you right now, a lot of thoughts go through your head when an airplane's on fire. And when they tell you which way to escape, I'm going to tell you are listening to that. Okay? I didn't come up with my own plan. I didn't. I listened to the people who knew what was best to get me off the airplane. God knows what's best to get us out of temptation. He knows what's best. So the first thing that you have to understand is you have to listen to God in order for you to have a way of escape. You can't devise this on your own. You've got to listen to God. So he says there's, the Greek word is ekbasis, which is the successful way out. That's what it means, the successful way out. Look at 2 Corinthians, the 5th chapter here. So Paul's talking to the same church, the same brethren. They're dealing with the same problems. And it would really help if I was in 2 Corinthians. And he says here, verse 18 of 2 Corinthians 5, he says, "Now all these things are from God, who reconciled us to himself through Christ and gave us the ministry of reconciliation, namely that God was in Christ reconciling the world to himself, not counting their trespasses against them, and he has committed to us the word of reconciliation." So Paul, telling these same people that there's a way out of temptation, he's saying God has reconciled you to him, and he's told you how to do it through the word of reconciliation. So if you're in this situation of temptation and you say, "I just don't know how to do it," God's already explained it, because he said the temptation you're in is common. It's not new. It's not been invented recently. It's something that's been out there for a long time. He's already given us direction on how to do it. We have to listen and we have to follow the instruction. He made his son, look at this in 2 Corinthians, the 5th chapter, verse 21, just past this. He said, "He made him who knew no sin to be sin on our behalf, that we might become the righteousness of God in him." You know what he's saying when he says this is, he said, you've been in this situation of being surrounded by sin, being affected by sin, and being a sinner. Each one of us has been in that situation. Surrounded by sin, involved in sin, we are sinners. And he said, "My son came to this earth," and he said, "he never did that. He was surrounded by sin, he was affected by sin, but he never became a sinner." And he said, "but he became sin. He took on all of our sins. He took them on himself, and he bore them as a sacrifice on the cross so that God could reconcile us to him." That's what Paul wants us to understand, is that there's a plan. Now, Jesus, that's part of the plan. Jesus is part of this plan, and you're not going to get there without him. So, he's telling us God loved us so much that he sent his son to die. So, how does he provide us a way of escape? I've from my youth, I've thought about this scripture, and I think, you know, I was in this situation, and if God was going to provide a way of escape, how come it wasn't just easy? How come it just didn't happen, you know? Pull the ripcord, boom, balloon comes out or parachute comes out, I'm safe now. Well, the way of escape was he gave us the parachute, right? But we had to pull the ripcord. He didn't pull the handle for us. He's given us the tools to get through salvation or through temptation. And Brian touches on this a lot in his sermons. He talks about, you know, if you've got a problem with something, get rid of it. You don't have to have it in front of you all the time. Get rid of it. Put yourself in a situation where it's not in front of you all the time. Well, this is why this lesson's hard. I'm all over the place. I'm in Sodom right now. I'm in the world today. And I've got Jesus on the cross. So I'm going to try to pull all this together for us. So he sent his son to die to provide us a way of escape. This is where each of us, we've got to step out of me trying to figure everything out for myself and go back to the fundamentals of being a Christian. Listening to God. Quit trying to figure a new way out of everything, and quit trying to hold on to something that isn't helpful, and let go of it. Let go of it and go in the direction that he would have us go. This is the hard part. I'm a little bit of a hoarder. I have a hard time getting rid of some of my stuff. I have a bunch of tools. And Angela will say, "Get rid of some of this stuff." And I'm like, "I might need it. I might need it. I haven't used it in 5 years, but I might need it." And she's like, "Jeff, get rid of it." Sin's the same way. I've enjoyed this. It doesn't lead me in the direction towards righteousness, but I've enjoyed it. And it's not necessarily sinful, but it could lead to a situation where sin's now right next to me. And so, let go of it. Right, Brian? Get rid of it. That's the way of escape. Release that grip. If you're living in Corinth, don't go to the house of the fellow who believes in Athena and that has offered a sacrifice to that god and now has laid that food on the table. You say, no, I'm not coming over. I'm not going to eat that. Don't go to the marketplace where your brethren can see you that you're buying this meat that's sacrificed to idols. Don't do that if you know they're there and they see you. Don't put yourself in a situation where you lend yourself to sinning or being tempted to sin. That's what he's telling them specifically. He's telling them this idolatry and this tremendous pressure to be part of the culture of Corinth. I understand it. It's strong. Everybody's doing it. It's a small pocket of Christians there. And they're going to ostracize you. They're going to push you out. They're going to make you not part of the community because of that. And even in the church, because of the philosophies and the way they believe, they're not going to look at you the same if you don't have the same education, if you will, on life. So he tells them in 1 Corinthians 10, in verse 21, same chapter that we're in, 1 Corinthians 10, 21. If you read on, he says, you cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons. You cannot partake of the table of the Lord and the table of demons. You know what he's saying there? He's saying you can't walk in both worlds. You can't. Yes, we walk in the world that God created and we're surrounded by evil. But you can't participate in the evil. So we have got to figure out, how do we get around this? How do we get around this? You know, there's so many things. And some of them we love. We love family. All of us has family that we love. And sometimes our family is going to pull us in the wrong direction. And we have to be the example to our family all the time. And I think everybody here understands this, because I think each of us is affected by this in some way or another. So we can't be part of everything. We can certainly have associations. And Paul even told us that. He says, you can't leave the world. I'm not telling you to leave the world. He says, I'm telling you how to act while you're in the world. So what these men in Corinth are suffering from is really a lack of conviction. They haven't set their heart truly on serving God. And so the world itself is such an allurement to them, and the influence of the world is so much that they're struggling with how to get out of the temptation that's going to lead them to sin. Boy, can I relate to that. Depending on who my friend is or my workplace or the things that I'm doing that day, it's right there. Boom. It's right in front of me, and I'm affected by it. Each of us are, right? Do we say the right thing when people are saying wrong things about God or are speaking evil about others? Do we engage in that, or do we step aside from that? Do we defend truth, or do we just keep silent? That's what he's talking about. When we talk, how we act, what we do. So, in Romans the 8th chapter, and I am going to get back to Sodom, I promise. In Romans the 8th chapter, verses 15 through 18, this is what Paul says here. He says, for you have not received a spirit of slavery leading to fear again, but you have received the spirit of adoption as sons, by which we cry out, Abba, Father. The Spirit himself bears witness with our spirit that we are children of God. And if children, heirs also, heirs of God and fellow heirs with Christ, if indeed we suffer with him, in order that we may also be glorified with him. You know what Paul's telling us? He's telling us that in these processes of overcoming temptation, sometimes it hurts. Sometimes it's difficult. Sometimes we don't like the path we have to walk. It's plain and simple. He didn't say that overcoming temptation was easy. You won't see that in there. There's nowhere in there that it even alludes to the idea that you overcoming temptation was easy. Was it easy for Jesus? I mean, look at the things that he endured after his temptation by Satan. God sent angels to minister to him because of how difficult it had been on him. We minister to each other. We help each other if we're doing our part. We encourage one another in temptations. We have to know one another and love one another to do that, don't we? So I got Lot living in Sodom, and there's nobody ministering to Lot. Nobody. but he's righteous. And so I have to assume, based on what Peter has said and based on what we read in Genesis, that Lot is appealing to God constantly for the situation that he finds himself in. That Lot is longing for righteousness to be around him. But he can't figure out how to get out of this. So you want to know why I think what I think about Lot's family? If you would, and I think I'm into this point in my lesson, turn to Genesis, the 19th chapter. Genesis 19, and go down to about verse 16. So, I'm not going to cover the whole thing, but remember, God sent two men to Lot and his family. We already understand the men of the city tried to assault them and abuse them. So he's told them, Lot, we're here to rescue you. We're here to help you out. Now, I would ask everybody to go back and reread this all in its entirety, because I don't have time to do all of this. But he says, verse 16, let's start in verse 15. And when morning dawned, the angels urged Lot, saying, up, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, lest you be swept away in the punishment of the city. But he hesitated. Now that word right there doesn't mean that he was like, no, that he's pulling back. It means that he tarried. That's all it means. He tarried. He hesitated. He didn't see the urgency of what the angels are telling him. So keep that in mind, because I think sometimes when we read that, we think that Lot's got his heels dug in. I think he just doesn't understand the urgency of what these men are telling him. So it says, he hesitated. So the men, now get this, the men seized him, his hand, and the hand of his wife, and the hands of his two daughters, for the compassion of the Lord was upon him, and they brought him out and put him outside the city. And it came about when they had brought them outside that one said, escape for your life. Do not look behind you and do not stay anywhere in the valley. Escape to the mountains lest you be swept away. Okay, so here's something really important with this whole thing. It's a different situation and it's a different time. And remember, in the Old Testament, we saw a lot of physical illustrations to the spiritual message, right? So here we have a man who's surrounded by sin, living in this corruptness. The men were described as being insolent, wanting pleasure. That's all they want. Barclay says that this is the ugliest word in the list of New Testament sins. It is defined as prepared for every pleasure, violence coupled with insult and audacity, a disposition of the soul which does not possess and cannot bear the pain of discipline. That's just a little bit of it. There's a lot more I could read. That's what he's saying. These are the men that he's surrounded about. Wicked, wicked, wicked. Everything about him is wicked. So God seizes him by the hand and he tells him, don't look back. Now I think the reason that Lot is being seized by his hand is because, and I think the reason that Lot has tarried is because his daughters have two men that they're engaged to that don't believe, and they've laughed and they're not coming. They're not coming. And I think that Lot's wife isn't interested in leaving either. So he's hesitating because these family members he loves are holding him back. He's tarried just a little bit. And so God's compassion, they grab each of them by the hand. There's two men and there's four people. They got some person on each hand. And they drag them out of the city with urgency. Now look at what he says next. He said to them, do not look behind you and do not stay anywhere in the valley. Escape to the mountains lest you be swept away. So, I think what we see is that Lot's family, not Lot, but Lot's family has become acclimated to the lifestyle of Sodom. We know what happens next, right? They get away. So Lot asks if he can go to a small city. He said, we can't survive in the mountains. So they let him go to a small city called Zoar. Lot's wife gets there. And she looks back. Now, I've thought about this a lot. I may be wrong. But I think when Lot's wife looks back, she's looking back longing for what she left. I don't think she's looking back to see the smoke and the fire. I think she's looking back because she never wanted to leave there in the first place. This is all supposition on my part, and if I'm wrong, I apologize. But I think the context tells us that this family didn't want to leave, and God had compassion on them and mercy. So where does this all lead us to? Escape for your life. In order to escape, in order for us to escape sin, temptation, I have to do something. God is not going to just pull me by the hand and lead me the whole way and then put himself up as a shield to protect me from looking back. He has given me his hand. This is it right here. He's given me his hand. And he said, Jeff, if you want to live, take this and follow the instruction. Lot, take my hand, escape to the mountains or the city, follow my instruction. This is the men's hands right here, holding mine. Escape. Now, if I turn around and I go, I like that over there, and I go that way, then I haven't taken the way of escape, have I? He gave them a way of escape. He pulled them out of the city. That wasn't the way of escape. He told them, don't look behind and don't tarry, go. That's what God does for us each day. It's right here, every bit of it. We see in this particular set of passages, we see the compassion of God. Peter even talks about the compassion of God. He said, because he was compassionate, he did this. We see a man who was tormented, worn down by the conduct of those he lived around. And the men seized his hands and his family's hands, and he took them out of the city. We see that God gave them a way of escape. We see God kept his promise to both Lot, his wife, and his daughters. He said, if you'll go this way, I'll keep you alive. And he promised them that if they didn't look back, they would live. And he promised them if they did look back, they would die. And Lot's wife looked back, and she died. God kept every promise when he rescued them out of Sodom. To every one of them, he kept his promise. Lot's wife chose to not follow the way of escape. Do we choose to follow God's way of escape, or are we like Lot's wife, looking at the world we live in, like those in Corinth, and we feel the pressures of the people that we live around? And is that so great that when God has extended his hand to us and said, follow my son, who I reconciled you to myself through him, who took your sin upon himself and I hung him on the tree so that you could be with me. That's what he's talking about. He's not talking about that some man is going to physically come and pull me out of a bar in a dance club and say, hey, listen, if you keep doing this, you're not going to go to heaven. Now, I might have a brother that does that at some point in my life and says, Jeff, come with me. What you're doing is wrong. And we should do that towards one another. But what he's saying is, my plan's in place. Listen to my plan and follow it and live. Paul is speaking of a spiritual salvation here. The escape from eternal death. That's what he's really talking about. Are you following God's way or man's way? I put these scriptures up here. I'm not going to go over them because I don't want to spend the extra time, but I think these are a good complement. If you want to just write those down and read them in part of this lesson, because they help us to understand how much God loved us. and what he did to reconcile us to him, and why it's so important for us to follow his word at all times. He's given us that way of escape. Remember, we have to take it, and we have to follow his instruction and do our part. The lesson's yours. If there's anyone here this morning who has any needs, then we invite you as together we stand and we sing.